Our fourth case for argument this morning is United States against Burhide. Mr. Murray.
May it please the court, I'm Jim Murray. I represent Kent Burhide. Economic reality, that's what a trial court is supposed to look for when imposing sentence, but our trial court ignored that. Delaying a collection action by a few weeks is not the equivalent of obtaining a loan fraudulently in the first place. Our defendant, in this case, legitimately obtained a loan of $521,000.
Does the record show what the bank might have been able to obtain had it foreclosed and collected everything it could at the time that Burhide put it off?
There's been no attempt by the government or probation to show that there was any collateral of significance. There is a reference to there being three rolls of carpeting found in one of the failed business sites in early August when People's State Bank resumed its repossession action, but there's been no suggestion that there is any property, cash, or other collateral of any consequence left in this business.
I suppose Judge Shabazz might have thought that that Burhide intended to have this interruption continue permanently or for a long time or something of that sort. Is that possible?
I don't believe so. The agreement, the forbearance agreement, induced in part by pledging real property and in part, that's why this is a crime, by pledging property that had been transferred, was only going to involve a delay of several weeks. Mr. Burhide, if things had run their course, would have had to have the prospective buyer he hoped to have by August 15th, if I'm not mistaken, and close the deal with the prospective buyer by August 31st.
Of course, it wouldn't make any difference, even if he had delayed it until the sun dies. If the value of the loan at the time of the delay was zero, the loss, I suppose, from a perpetual delay would be zero. On the other hand, it makes one wonder why your client was committing criminal fraud in order to delay the bank's collection efforts. If there wasn't anything the bank could have collected, why do you commit a crime in order to stave it off?
It seems silly to me. It's not an issue that was raised by the government.
But it implies that your client is just gratuitously committing crimes, you know, in the hope of running up his sentence or something like that. And normally, we assume that criminals have some rational objective.
My speculation on this part is that he hoped there was going to be a buyer. This is all geared up to buying a few weeks. Have a buyer come in who sinks new money into the business and keeps my client and his wife out of bankruptcy. As we see from other counts that are not disputed here, my client had slightly more property than he could probably comfortably protect in a bankruptcy, and we're not disputing the portion of the sentence that stems from his failing to disclose certain assets that he and his wife had, but whether it's the stigma of bankruptcy or whether the fact that he was going to have to cough up some property in a bankruptcy, he was trying to find a seller to come in and sell the and rather buy the business and take away his debt. It's natural for people to want their debt to go away in bankruptcies, even under the old bankruptcy code, not something that usually is the first choice for somebody personally or in a business context. May have been wishful thinking on his part, not surprisingly. No buyer turned up to buy a failing business and pump more cash into it, and the forbearance agreement fell apart, we know, in early August because, as the government tells us, People's State Bank's agents were running around grabbing what rolls of carpeting remained. This was a crime. No one's disputing that there's a crime that was committed by Mr. Burhide, and he'll be amply punished by the 7 points that we agree are his offense level if it is reduced as it should be. However, no matter how annoying the delaying the forbearance agreement was to People's State Bank, and no matter how criminal this was, regardless of whether or not People's State Bank reasonably relied on this, there just is no proof that a dime was cost to People's State Bank by delaying from July until early August when they actively resumed collection actions. There are no cases dealing with the time value of delay, if you will, that I've been able to find or that the government has cited. The government tries to paint things with a broad brush, just grabbing loan cases which involve the procurement of a loan by fraud in the first place. It's understandable that if one lies to obtain thousands or millions of dollars, depending on the case, well, that's the appropriate loss figure. But in this case, this $550,000 loan was obtained legitimately more than a year before the crime, and it's just not...
How did the bank learn of this sale of collateral?
I suspect they belatedly got around to filing that mortgage they were given. If they had gotten around to
a title report that showed the property was sold or something.
The property was transferred the day before this worthless pledge was made. If they had gone down to the Register of Deeds office, they would have found out sooner that they had been victimized. But I'm assuming it was a trip to the Register of Deeds directly or through a title company that made them aware, and that's what presumably caused them to breach their end of the breach bargain and run into the stores and begin repossessing.
What do you calculate the sentence should be as opposed to what it was?
I believe when this $521,000 loss is eliminated, because it was not a loss, that's a loan amount. It's a tempting number, it's a simple number, but it's a harsh number and an unfair number. I believe that the appropriate sentence should be between 21 and 27 months based on there being proven losses of more than $120,000 under the relevant guidelines. Mr. Berheide, however, was sentenced to 37 months, the maximum of the erroneously calculated range of 30 to 37.
What do you make of Judge Chavez's comment that he would give him 37 months, whether the guidelines were mandatory or not?
I find it suspicious because it's right down to the same day as he would have gotten under the guidelines. I shouldn't say that I find it suspicious, but I find it grounded in the guidelines. The fact that it's down to the day, the fact that he says the guidelines in the alternative are advisory, certainly he took strong counsel from that advice. He followed the advice of the guidelines. He gave Mr. Berheide a sentence under the guidelines as erroneously calculated by the trial court.
So we shouldn't take him as his word. We should remand and let him resentence?
And as I argue, this is an unusual case. We knew Booker was coming, and we had an addendum to protect my client's rights. I believe that this client might be the last person who could be legitimately sentenced now in 2005 under binding guidelines, and I would love the sure thing of resentencing between 21 and 27 months.
I don't understand that. This man was sentenced in much the same position, and indeed in much the same way, as the defendant in United States against George. And we held in George that there was no need for a remand. There are about 6 months of defendants in this position, sentenced after our opinion in Booker and before the Supreme Courts. And we said in George that the judge in George did just exactly what the district judge did here. And we said that was fine. Is there any ground on which George would not be controlling?
I'm afraid I do not know George, but assuming that there was no error in the sentencing guideline calculations in George, these are very different cases. Where a judge makes an error in the guidelines, then...
That I understand. It has nothing to do with Booker. Right? What we've said with respect to all Booker cases, that the first step, even after Booker, is determining the correct guideline range. So if there's an error in determining the correct guideline range, you have something. And if there's not, you don't.
All right. And given that there's an error in the calculation of the guideline range here, whether we're on the old system or a new system, having a judge working off erroneously calculated guidelines, whether they are binding or whether they are non-binding but advisory and certainly very influential to this judge in this case, that's an error that prejudices the client, and he does deserve a remand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. My name is Robert Anderson. I represent the United States in this appeal. I think it's clear from certainly from the appellant's reply brief and from his acknowledgments to the court here that they are waiving any argument under Booker, not just the Sixth Amendment waiver that he did at the sentencing, but any application. They prefer to be sentenced under the mandatory guidelines, and that constitutes waiver of any possible error under that, so there would be no possibility for remand that way. The guidelines here were correctly calculated.
Sounds like actually what they want is they prefer mandatory guidelines, and they prefer the judge not to make any adverse factual findings in implementing the guidelines.
The best of both worlds.
Exactly.
Well,
what many litigants want.
How can you justify the $550,000 for a 3 weeks delay or whatever?
Well,
that's the basic issue here, it seems to me.
We presented testimony at
and the judge didn't in his statements. I don't see any rationale that he propounded for arriving at this result.
Well, if you look at the sentencing transcript, we presented the testimony of the vice president of the bank because we knew they were contesting this. At the time that this forbearance agreement was entered into, Mr. Berhaide was representing to the bank that this $500,000+ of the loan still existed. He still had these assets, and he wanted them to forbear on executing on those.
Right. And let's assume that that's a bunch of baloney. Right, that's what he now says.
Yeah, he's now saying that
the loss
is already gone.
Loss for guideline purposes is either the actual loss,
correct,
which so far as we can tell is zero, or the intended loss, which so far as I can see is zero. Because the intended loss is the difference between what the bank would have collected had it executed right then and what the bank actually was likely to collect given the forbearance agreement. And if both of those numbers are zero, then the anticipated or expected or hoped-for loss is zero. Now, that leaves the question that I asked your adversary, which is why do people commit crimes for no possible gain? But in no circumstance would the expected loss be the difference between the original loan value and the bank's ultimate collection, because that may have disappeared before the forbearance agreement is signed.
And that seems to be what he's claiming, that stuff didn't even exist when he's duping the bank and entering this forbearance agreement.
What didn't
and
exist?
If he did that...
hold up. What didn't exist? Something didn't exist.
He's saying that by the time they entered the forbearance agreement, like Judge Easterbrook is observing, the assets were already gone.
Right.
They weren't there anymore.
Right.
And if that's the case, then he committed a loan fraud.
If that's so, then the expected loss is zero.
Only for those 2 weeks. But that's looking at it myopically.
The expected loss from this transaction is zero. If the bank could have collected zero at the time, and it was expected to collect zero later, the difference between these numbers is the expected loss, and zero minus zero is zero. Now, your position would have to be that the bank could have collected something but for the forbearance agreement. The district judge didn't make such a finding, however, did it?
No.
Certainly the district judge didn't find, and the pre-sentence report didn't suggest, that the bank could have collected $500,000 but for the forbearance agreement.
No, but as you asked, was there any specific finding regarding what was there when they were trying to do the replevin?
Be able to determine that either the actual or the anticipated or expected or hoped for loss was greater than trivial.
We have to go back to looking at you have the $500,000 loan with collateral for that loan. And he's representing that he has accounts receivable, he has assets. When the bank goes in May, they discover he misrepresented his account receivable and his assets.
He didn't when he got the loan, though. That's the problem.
So perhaps he committed a loan fraud to begin with. But
wait a minute.
Which is then relevant conduct to his whatever he did on the forbearance agreement. But the forbearance agreement was easier to establish. And
I understand that, but the, I don't see what relevant conduct's got to do with anything. But
well, the if he dissipated the assets even before he got to the forbearance agreement, it's relevant to the loss calculation for the loan.
The loan, only if getting the loan was itself part of a fraudulent scheme. Did
which,
you offer to show, or did the district judge find that getting the loan was itself part of a fraudulent scheme?
We had alleged in the indictment that, that the loan from Associated Bank, which was the other bank that had $140,000 in losses, and this loan were all part of the series of events and scheme. And the fact that this bank
so
later discovered
is yes, you allege this.
Alleged and would have alleged at trial that
what misrepresentation was made when he got the loan, if any.
What misrepresentations were made, and what the bank found when they went to start Riplevin and found that these assets
weren't
there. Well,
they didn't represent that. That had nothing. That what came on later with this forbearance agreement. But it didn't. There wasn't any misrepresentation when the loan was made. At least,
but
I haven't heard about any.
Right. Was there one?
I'm sorry. What?
Was there a misrepresentation made to obtain the loan?
The bank in May went in and did an audit, and they found, it's in the record, and it's not disputed, that the bank found that, that there were misrepresentations, that, that he did not have accounts receivable accurate, did not accurately disclose accounts receivable, did not accurately disclose the assets that he used to get this loan. And that's why...
Well, the judge doesn't say anything about that.
Pardon?
Judge Shabazz doesn't say anything about that in his sentencing transcript that I can see.
No, he didn't need to because he was addressing the total loss of I'm sorry.
Nor does any other source. I mean, your brief doesn't take this argument seriously, and you should have. Your brief devotes its entire argument to an argument about Booker that was never made and isn't properly presented if it were, and doesn't do anything to pin down what the actual loss was.
We presented testimony as to what the actual loss was from the vice president. They lost as
well,
a result.
The ultimate loss was $400,000, but that's not ascribable to the forbearance agreement, as far as I can make out.
It may not be specifically ascribable to those 2 weeks, but it is ascribable to his course of conduct in the bankruptcy fraud and the loan transactions, which are relevant to what he was doing with the forbearance agreement as well.
If the if the $500,000 loss fell out, do you think Judge Shabazz would be restricted on the maximum sentence he could impose?
No.
There are other factors that you could address on remand, then, would there not be?
There would be. We could address the other factors and issues relating to the losses. There was no dispute in that realm. There was no dispute that at risk, the bank had at risk as a result of this loan, the $522,000 at the time they entered into the forbearance agreement.
You put something at risk for 2 weeks, is that the same as putting it at risk permanently?
It was at risk before that 2 weeks happened, and it was at risk.
I don't understand that. Why was it at risk?
That was the balance on the loan that he had, and if he already dissipated the assets, the bank didn't know about it, and he was concealing it. And the forbearance was just the act or the crime of getting them to enter into this forbearance was just merely a perpetuation of the crime he had already started. And there was no dispute that the hidden assets in the bankruptcy totaled $54,000. The loss to Associated Bank was $140,000. So when we total all those up, even if you only take the actual loss to People's Bank, that's still in the $500,000 to $800,000 range. If If this is supposed no loss as a result of his conduct related to the bankruptcy, I got to ask, what happened to the money that was loaned to him? Where did it go? And if he didn't keep those assets and that collateral that he pledged to the bank when he got the loan, that was in violation of the loan and a crime in and of itself, which again is related to the forbearance.
Is it a crime to violate a loan agreement?
If you have collateral that's securing that loan, and they have a right to that collateral, then the dissipation of that collateral is a violation.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a violation of the loan agreement. It's not a crime. We do not live in a world where all breach of contract is criminal.
Well, selling a secured asset without. Without
the Uniform Commercial Code is not a criminal code. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Murray?
Yes, briefly, Your Honor. The final count and the count of conviction in this indictment charges Mr. Berheide with overvaluing the security interest in a false statement in connection with the forbearance agreement. He is not accused in the indictment, and there is no proof before the trial court that he broke the law in any other respect as to People's State Bank. The government put on a case at sentencing and today, which would be a fine civil case in terms of this man's civil liability and having committed bankruptcy fraud. This is civil liability that this person will be stuck with. But for purposes of the criminal justice system, for purposes of criminal sentencing, as opposed to some collection matter, he is just not as blameworthy as a person who had lied to obtain $500,000. Thank you so much.
And Mr. Murray, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.